Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. We've had some wild weather this past week, but I was looking up information on past years, and I found this. On June 8th, today, in 1882, it's reported that 17-inch hailstones fell in Dubuque, Iowa. They were reported to weigh as much as 1.75 pounds. Yes, you heard me right, 17-inch hailstones weighing 1.75 pounds. So if you think we had it bad with our recent storms, remember that they were nothing like what they had in Iowa in 1882. Coming up on the show today, we'll have an interview with Katie Swalwell, a professor in the School of Education at ISU. She'll be talking about her new book about amazing women in Iowa's history. We'll also be talking about Rummage Rampage, which takes place in July and is becoming an Ames tradition. It might seem early to be thinking about Rummage Rampage, but we'll be talking about what you can do right now to get ready for it. And of course, it's Friday, so we have Dennis Hart with the news.
We begin with Tuesday's Tribune, which reported on what Ames residents can expect this summer in terms of street repair and construction projects. One of them involves 13th Street from Ridgewood to Harding Avenues. The project consists of tearing out old pavement, pouring new concrete, and updating water mains and storm sewers. Crews will start on the west side of 13th and work east. Another project involves the Skunk River near Carr Park to the Homewood Golf Course. Work crews will stabilize areas along the west side of the Skunk's Bank to protect the sewer and stabilize slope bank areas from erosion by removing trees and reestablishing more native vegetation. There are more projects in the works, including asphalt street improvements on Pierce Avenue, Pierce Circle, and Tyler Avenue. There are also water main installations on Kellogg Avenue between 24th and 28th and on 18th Street between Clark and Burnett. Meadow Lane from Carr Drive to East 20th will have its pavement replaced, and Carr Drive, Crestwood Circle, East 16th, and Linden Drive will have storm and sanitary sewer repairs along with new pavement. In addition, Dawes Drive is having storm sewer improvements, and West Lincoln Way from County Line Road to around 980 feet east of County Line Road will have new asphalt. Tuesday's Trib also reported that Iowa State University has thawed a pay freeze that was enacted last summer. All ISU employees with satisfactory performance will get a 1% raise or more in the 2019 budget year, starting July 1st. In addition, administrators could approve raises up to 10% for so-called extraordinary performance, retention, and adjustments based on market rates or equity. The Trib also had word on community meetings set to take place Thursday, June 7th, to get the public's input on the project to build a new Ames High. Since voters approved passage of a $110 million bond referendum in April, OPN Architects has been getting input on the needs and wants of school district stakeholders about the new facility. Three community meetings were set for Thursday. At each one, OPN representatives plan to update the project's progress. At earlier sessions, school board members and district representatives were asked to brainstorm about what the future high school should look like. District representatives also had a chance to review a wall of design photos and mark them with red and green stickers representing likes and dislikes. Tuesday's Trib also reported that a new business has opened on Main Street. Ames Spine and Sport is now in the building that formerly housed the Ames Sewing and Vacuum Center, which closed after 36 years when the owner and most of its staff retired. The building's storefront has been completely remodeled. And with Tuesday being primary election day in Ames and around Iowa, the Trib reported that more than 1,300 Story County voters, mostly Democrats, had requested absentee ballots or voted early. Story County Auditor Lucy Martin said the absentee numbers are up from 4 years ago, which was the most recent midterm election year. Martin estimated that this year's election turnout numbers could resemble those from 2010, when 12.5% of eligible voters actually voted. Polls opened at 7 Tuesday morning and stayed open until 9 that night. And what voters did, what they decided on Tuesday, dominated front page news in Wednesday's Tribune. On a statewide level, retired Des Moines businessman and philanthropist Fred Hubble won the Democratic nomination for governor. He will face incumbent Republican Governor Kim Reynolds in the November general election. Hubble defeated a field of five other Democratic candidates. He won nearly 53% of the vote in Story County. After his victory, Hubble said, in his words, "We've got to turn this state around, and we don't have time to waste." Reynolds was unopposed in the Republican primary. She said, in her words, This will be a very important election. It will help decide who we are as a people and what kind of Iowa we want to pass on to our children. Libertarian Jake Porter defeated primary opponent Marco Battaglia. Meanwhile, Sioux City paralegal and former pro baseball player J.D. Scholten won the 4th Congressional District's Democratic nomination on Tuesday night. He will face incumbent Republican Steve King in the November general for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. Scholten easily defeated Spencer City Councilwoman Leanne Jacobson and Ames pediatrician John Passion. Passion finished third. Republican King easily defeated primary challenger Cindy Hansen, and Charles Aldrich won the uncontested election for the Libertarian nomination. In the Iowa Senate District 25 primary, Republican incumbent Annette Sweeney easily defeated challenger Chad Buss. Democrat Tracy Freese ran unopposed and won her party's nomination. The Trib had other election stories Wednesday, including word that a software glitch forced some Story County voters to fill out their eligibility forms manually during Tuesday's primary. The problem apparently affected all polling places in the county. Computers there did not have voter ID forms for voters with last names starting with the letters A or M. Those voters had to fill out their ID forms manually, writing out their names and addresses and signing it before they received their ballots. Those forms were the same ones the computers would have printed out, and the voters who had to fill out their forms manually received their ballots and got to vote. There was other local news in Wednesday's Trib, and if you looked on the last page of the front section, you'd see it. One of the stories involved the Ames School Board, which voted this week to keep substitute teacher pay rates for the district the same as it has been for the past couple of years, $100 a day. The daily rates for substitutes will increase after 11 days in the same assignment. By comparison, substitutes in the Des Moines and Ankeny public schools made $135 per day this past year, while those in the Ballard School District made $110 a day. Another story involved the upcoming Registered's annual Great Bicycle Ride across Iowa. Riders who will be coming into Ames for an overnight stop on July 24th will have the chance to ride through Jack Trice Stadium. This will be a first-of-its-kind experience for RAGBRAI. The hope is that in the future, cities like Iowa City and Cedar Falls will make the same opportunities available to riders. Thursday's Trib reported on that big thunderstorm that roared its way into Ames and Story County late Wednesday afternoon. That storm dropped coin-sized hail on the city and whipped up winds as high as 71 miles an hour. It knocked down tree limbs and power lines. The police department received one call about a biker who was hit by a falling tree limb. Several big limbs came down at the intersection of Iowa Avenue and Ross Road, and numerous limbs were knocked down in the historic Old Town neighborhood. One car got stuck in the Grand Avenue underpass when it flooded, and the driver had to be helped out. Ames Police Sergeant Elijah Hansen said in his words, "It was a hectic hour or so." Of course, there was other news in Thursday's Trib, including a story about the upcoming 4th Congressional District battle between Democrat J.D. Scholten and incumbent Republican Congressman Steve King. Scholten and King won their party's nominations in the Tuesday primaries. The Tribune quoted Iowa State Assistant Professor of Political Science David Anderson, who said Scholten seems well-positioned to give King the best race he's had in a long time. Scholten has raised more campaign money than King in the last two quarters. King has won all eight of his congressional elections. Scholten said he would like to debate King. Currently, a nonpartisan newsletter that handicaps congressional elections, the Cook Political Report, rates the 4th District as reliably Republican. It does not list King's seat as a competitive race. Still on the political beat, Thursday's Tribune reported that Story County Attorney Jessica Reynolds, who is a Democrat, has endorsed Republican County Supervisor Rick Sanders for re-election. Reynolds said she's doing it after seeing what Sanders has accomplished at the county level in his 8 years on the board. Reynolds said Sanders has shown the ability to balance the county's budget, double funding to social services, enhance mental health services, and improve communication and cooperation within Story County and outside. Sanders said he was surprised and gratified to receive Reynolds' endorsement. Sanders and fellow Republican Martin Chitty are running for re-election, joining Democrats Linda Merkin and Joshua Opperman on the November ballot. There was more in Thursday's Trib, including word that the longtime director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State University is one of four women who will be inducted into the Iowa Women's Hall of Fame this summer. Diane Bystrom has been director of the Catt Center since 1996. Among other things, she has taught courses on leadership, women in politics, and political campaigns, has contributed to, co-authored, or authored 21 books, and is a frequent media commentator for political and women's issues. She has also raised more than $4 million in private endowment and annual funds for research, outreach, and leadership programs. She will retire as director of the Catt Center in August. On the crime beat, Thursday's Trib reported that another Des Moines man has been arrested in connection with an April robbery at an Ames home. 18-year-old Rajon LaSalle Ray has been charged with robbery and theft in connection with an incident at a home in the 1100 block of Grand Avenue. Police said a group of men entered a party at the house, got into an argument with some of those attending, and stole wallets and cell phones from numerous partygoers. Several of those attending were injured. Four other people were arrested in connection with that incident last week. And two more quick notes from Thursday's trip, both from the Business Beat. A combination furniture store and cafe has opened in West Ames. It's the Cornucopia in the 6,000 block of West Lincoln Way. And the Cabin Coffee Company, which is an Iowa-based business chain, hopes to open a store near the 13th Street Highway interchange this coming November. And that is your summary of a busy week of news indeed from the pages of the Ames Tribune. I'm KHOA Civic Reporter Dennis Hart. I'll be back next Wednesday with a look at news from the pages of several nearby newspapers. Meanwhile, I hope you have a healthy, safe, and happy weekend.
Thanks to Dennis Hart for that news summary. We'll now hear from another of our Local Talk contributors, Pat Schlaubaum, about respecting wildlife.
Phenology is recording nature's happenings when they occur. The first hepatica of spring or the last robin of autumn are noted in a journal for future reference. Or as Lee Searles puts it, phenology is the natural rhythms of life. Today we'll talk about care of young wildlife. Iowans are being reminded not to rescue wildlife babies. Springtime means baby season for Iowa wildlife, beginning with the first hatch great horned owls in March, on to June when most of the pheasant chicks arrive, and nothing looks more innocent and cute than baby animals. And on occasion, these cute, fluffy, and feathery, and clumsy, and gangly babies are discovered all alone and rescued from their mother in a cardboard box and whisked to the nearest office of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. While the rescuer may have had the best intentions, they likely have doomed the very animal they aim to save. Many wildlife babies die soon after rescue from the stress of being handled, talked to, and placed into unfamiliar surroundings. Should it survive this trauma, they often succumb more slowly to starvation from improper nourishment, pneumonia, or other human-caused sicknesses. Here's a quote, "All species of wildlife have highly specific needs for survival," said Karen Kincaid, Wildlife Diversity Program Coordinator for the Iowa DNR. "Rescuing a baby from its mother not only shows bad judgment, it's illegal. Most mammals are nocturnal. Mother will hide her young during the day so she can sleep or look for food, so it's perfectly normal for the young to be alone or unattended during the day. Don't assume a fawn or a nest full of baby cottontails or raccoons are orphaned. The transition to independence varies by species, from as little as 4 or 5 days to weeks or even months. Most wildlife babies leave before they can care for themselves. They may become widely scattered during this fledgling period, but remain under the direct care and feeding of their parents. Young birds appear clumsy and vulnerable because they really are clumsy and vulnerable. As the fledging process continues, survivors smarten up fast, while slow learners quickly fade. Most birds have less than a 20% chance of surviving their first year, and that fledging is when they have their first flight or leave the nest. There is one large exception to assisting young wildlife in need. This involves young birds that have fallen from the nest. Returning them to the nest will not cause the mother to reject their young. Birds do not smell, and the birds will not abandon their young when humans touch them. It is a myth that was propagated by our grandparents, I think, so we would leave little birds alone. But you can return all young birds to their nest or above the ground and protect it from marauding cats. So put them in a fork of a tree or make a little platform, and the birds will be just fine. As the morel mushroom season hits full stride, so does the number of calls to the Iowa DNR about abandoned deer fawns. A fawn's self-defense is to remain motionless and blend in with the background vegetation, but that is often mistaken for abandonment. What callers don't realize is that the mother is likely hiding nearby waiting for them to leave so she can resume taking care of her fawn. The Iowa DNR does not rehabilitate or raise wild animals to the point of self-sufficiency. And because of the expanding presence of chronic wasting disease, which is a debilitating disease that there is no cure for, we do not allow deer to be taken to a private rehabilitator to be raised and released, said Tyler Harms, biometrician with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources Wildlife Research Section. Chronic wasting disease is a fatal neurological disease that affects deer, elk, moose, and caribou. In some locations where the disease has been the longest, it is causing population declines. The disease can be spread through saliva, urine, feces, and blood of an infected deer. Once shed into the environment, the infectious agent, a deformed prion protein, can remain viable and infect healthy deer for years. Infected does can pass along the disease to their fawns, if not before birth, afterward, through grooming and close contact. Infected deer may not show symptoms for about 2 years, making the disease difficult to find. There is currently no practical way to test live deer. The only way is to collect tissues of the lymph nodes from a dead deer and submit them to a lab for testing. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources appreciate the passion people have to protect fawns. We have it too, but all it takes is one infected deer to be taken to a pen or other area where it can infect other deer and the environment. Then the likelihood of any healthy deer getting sick at the facility increases dramatically. Harms said the best chance for fawns or baby ducks, raccoons, skunks, and birds to survive is for them to be left alone in the wild. And that's our phenology for today, but enjoy all the wildlife, and hopefully all your favorite species will be within your view this summer and autumn and coming months ahead. It's a great time of year. Just try to respect wildlife and let them be. This is Pat Schlarbaum for KHOY Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames.
It's the little old lady from Pasadena. The little old lady from Pasadena.
Go, granny, go, granny, go, granny, go.
Has a pretty little flower bed of white gardenias.
Go, granny, go, granny, go, granny, go.
But parked in a rickety old garage is a brand new shiny red super stock car.
And everybody's saying that there's nobody meaner than the little old lady from Pasadena.
She's the terror of Colorado Boulevard.
It's the little old lady from Pasadena.
If you see her on the street, don't try to choose her.
That song, Little Old Lady from Pasadena, was released by Jan and Dean on this day, June 8th, in 1964. Katie Swalwell is an associate professor in the School of Education at ISU. She specializes in social studies education and social justice education. I heard that she was working on a new book about women in Iowa's history, so I asked her to sit down and talk with me about it earlier this week. You're working on a book called Amazing Iowa Women A to Z. How did you come to write this book?
For a long time, I've been really interested in local history and specifically Iowa history. We don't do a very good job of teaching our history in the state, and there are so many areas where we can explore and help translate those histories for kids, especially younger kids in school. And I had kind of a long dream in the back of my mind to write a children's book someday, and I've just had a daughter this year. She's one now, and we got a lot of books like Rad Women A to Z and Bedtime Stories for Rebel Girls, and both of these books were so fantastic, and I got really excited when I thought about what if we had a book that captured the biographies and had beautiful portraits, just like Rad Women A to Z and Good Night Stories for Rebel Girls. What if we had something like that with biographies and portraits for Iowa women? And when I had spare time and in the evenings, I just started to do some research and try to find what those stories might look like, who might be some of the women that I would want to include. And I just got addicted to it. I have a spreadsheet with literally hundreds of women whose stories are so amazing, and then use this alphabet structure to just try to narrow it down a little bit and make sure that the women who are represented in the book are coming from all sorts of different backgrounds, different professions, different time periods, to really try to highlight and celebrate the incredible diversity and contributions of women throughout our state's history.
And you're from Iowa, and I saw in the advance copy of the book that you were generous enough to share with me so I could get a peek preview. In the beginning, you mention, I guess in kind of a dedication, that it's for your mom and your sister and now your daughter, all of whom were born in Iowa, as you were.
That's right. On one side of my family, I'm a fifth-generation Iowan. You know, I try really hard in the book, too, to make sure that newcomers to Iowa are also represented because they're just as much as part of this state as anyone else. I think for me, being from here and moving back as an adult and starting a family here, that I do really feel an attachment to this place, a very special connection, and a really deep passion for making sure that the state is a welcoming place, that it embraces everyone who's here, that it celebrates its history, that it learns from its history. I think because my family has such deep roots here, that makes me that much more committed to making sure that we have really good resources for teaching this history to young people.
And the book has, as you said, an A to Z format where it goes through the alphabet. Can you describe it to us? What does it look like for our listeners if someone opens the book?
This is one of the things that I'm most excited about, is the layout of the book and the artwork. So the layout is being done by Ray Gunn, which a lot of your listeners may be familiar with. It's a really fantastic store that started in Des Moines that celebrates everything about the Midwest, usually in kind of a cheeky way, but they have amazing graphic designers who are helping with the layout. So it looks very much like a lot of Ray Gunn products in terms of the font choice and the color palette that we're using. And then the illustrations, each letter represents a different woman, and then each illustration is a portrait of that woman created by an Iowa woman artist. So we have over 30 women artists with Iowa connections. Most of them still live in the state who are just phenomenal artists and have contributed. They all put in their request for who it was that they wanted to try to depict, and really everyone got matched up with someone that they were really passionate about. So all of the artwork even is created by a vast, diverse array of Iowa women artists. So it's really a celebration of Iowa women in every sense of the word. And the styles of the artists are really different. So we already have some of the portraits coming in. One is an oil painting. One is a digital illustration. One is a watercolor. Really different styles of art. I think it's going to make the illustrations really dynamic. And each of those tells a story in the images as much as the text explains it using words. So really the idea too for the book is that it will be something that all ages can enjoy. Really young children who are just learning to read, I think, will get a lot from the images, especially because there's so much symbolism in them. And then younger readers and elementary school students, middle school students, the text is really written at like a fourth, fifth grade level. So I think that kind of hits that middle-aged child. And then really the information, I think, will be so new to so many people that even older teenagers and adults, I think, will also be really intrigued. There's just a lot to learn. So I don't know if when you were looking at the advanced copy, if there were things that surprised you, but there were certainly a lot of things that surprised me when I was doing the research. And the challenge was just trying to figure out how to get as many of these incredible stories into this first volume.
Yeah, I was amazed at how few of the people I had ever heard of, and if I had heard of them, how little I really knew about what they had accomplished. So I definitely agree when you say that it will be interesting and informative for adults as well. Did you already know about all of these women and their accomplishments, or did you have to do a lot of research?
Yeah, I definitely spent a lot of time researching. My husband can attest that into the wee hours of the night, I just couldn't stop. Once you start going down these rabbit holes, they're so fascinating. There were a few resources that were really, really helpful to me. One was the Iowa Women's Archives, which is a fabulous resource that we have housed at the University of Iowa, actually co-founded by one of the women in the book, who the book is actually dedicated to. Her name is Louise Noun, and she was just an incredible woman, had her hands in lots of different things, and ended up helping to start this archive dedicated to capturing the stories of Iowa's women. So that archive that still exists and is doing really amazing work was very, very helpful. They have a great physical archives, but also great digital archives as well. And then there is also an Iowa Women's Award, like a Hall of Fame, but I think it's through the Department of Human Rights, that they have done a really great job every year of recognizing three or four women who've contributed to the state or to the nation or to the world in some way. And so that also is all cataloged and accessible with really short bios. So that was often a place that I started, with both the archives and then the list of the winners of this award, to try to start going down some of those rabbit holes and figuring out the different categories, different professions. Really, any Iowa history book I pick up, I immediately look to the appendix and scan through to see for any women's names, to try to just find whatever information I can. Most of the stories were fairly easy, I guess, to say that, you know, they're women whose stories I don't think are as widely known as they should be, but it wasn't like I had to dig in dusty corners of basement archives for years and years and years. They were fairly easy to find information about. So I think what's exciting to me is that some of these stories that have just been kind of on the surface are celebrated. A great example that people might have just heard about recently because of the NBA finals that are happening with the Golden State Warriors is a basketball player named Denise Long from Witten, Iowa, who was drafted by the NBA in 1969, the first woman to ever be drafted by the NBA, and maybe even the only woman, I'm not sure. She scored 111 points in one game and is really the most celebrated women's basketball star from her high school. State tournament was what drew the attention of the NBA. The NBA refused to honor the pick. She ended up getting recruited to like a predecessor of the WNBA that kind of stalled out after one season. But stories like that, you know, there are newspaper articles, like human interest pieces that might pop up every once in a while. But in terms of being like a celebrated person that Iowa students or young people or residents would know about and recognize, like, you know, I don't know if some of those stories have risen to that level. So I'm really excited to share them as widely as I can.
And you must have had more than you could include, because you just included one person for each letter of the alphabet.
I was a little sneaky. So the alphabet structure was actually kind of a nice way to hem me in, to make sure that it wasn't a book with, you know, 400 pages that would maybe bore people or be too overwhelming. When I knew I had the first letters to work with, the letters of the alphabet, and I corresponded that to the first letter of the women's first names, then I also had another variable that I thought about, which was era, time period, to make sure that that was roughly balanced throughout the alphabet. Mm-hmm. Another variable was profession. I wanted to make sure each letter represented a woman contributing in a different field. And then the other piece that I really considered was the woman's ethnic, religious, racial background to make sure that there was a really diverse array of women represented in the book. And once you have that kind of equation that you're running everything through, it really starts to fall into place. There was definitely some shifting around and some stories that I'm hoping to save for subsequent volumes of books that will look at Iowa's history through different perspectives, just to make sure those stories have a home. The other way that I was a little sneaky was each page has a biography of the woman that's represented by the letter, and then there's a little insert box that has kind of extra stories related to that particular field. So, for example, you know, Denise O'Brien is the D for Denise, and she's this really incredible farmer and advocate for family farms and women in farming and has done just amazing things with agriculture. And the inset box talks about other women who have also contributed in really amazing ways, like Jessie Shambaugh, who was the founder of 4-H, or Ruth Buxton Sayer, who's known as the first lady of the farms. But there's really some amazing women, Gertrude Dykin, who was the first female editor of the Farm Journal. So I tried to sneak in little snippets of those women, just kind of little teasers. And something I'm hoping that readers do is, even when they read in the little insert box that just hints at these other stories, that they then take it upon themselves to get online, to go to museums, to talk to people, to find out more information about these women. And certainly there are amazing women who didn't make it into the book. And that's something that I am really clear about in the preface, that hopefully this book triggers people doing whatever they can to document and celebrate and find out more about other women that they think are extraordinary or special or interesting.
I like that you decided to do it according to their first names, the women's first names. It makes it seem more personal, and also for women especially, because they often give up their name if they're married. Was that,
yes, that
was that intentional?
You know, the personal piece of it that you mentioned was definitely part of my thinking. And then also it is really tricky when women did change their names. Then it put me in a position of deciding which letter to use for their last names. And I just felt like, oh, that's not really my place to make that decision. Mm-hmm. So going with the first names makes them more familiar and then let me off the hook a little bit about which last names to use.
And in what you were just saying about how you hope that it provokes people to read more about the featured women, but also about the women in the little insert, is that what you see as the main impact of the book?
The first impact is hopefully just to engage readers. Obviously, I think anyone who writes a book is hoping for that. There are two other goals that I really hope happens. The first is that I really want to inspire particularly young women, but also other people as well, to really be able to see themselves reflected in this book and to feel some kind of personal inspiration. I can't tell you how many of these stories actually made me, an adult woman who's almost 40, feel inspired and feel like, wow, maybe I could do something like that. Like, really to feel some kind of empowerment and inspiration. That's one hopeful outcome. And the second is really to challenge the idea of who is an Iowan and what we're about as a state. I mentioned this earlier, just to really try to paint a portrait of our state community that really honors and celebrates people from totally different backgrounds, people like my family who maybe have been here for generations, Native people, refugees, immigrants, you know, people who came here for school, people who came here for work, people who were born here. I'm trying to create a resource that help inspire people to think of our state more broadly and more inclusively, and ideally a resource that all kids that are growing up here can find at least somebody in the book that looks like them, that is from a background like theirs, whether that's a social class background or ethnic or racial, religious background, so that they can feel connection to our state that I think very often in the national kind of public imagination is presented as really homogenous. And we actually have a much more interesting cultural, a much more rich tapestry in our state than I think sometimes we're known for. And I want to make sure that there's a resource that families and teachers can use with kids to help them understand that.
Well, as I listen to you talk about it, I definitely want to get a copy of this book.
Okay.
So, and I'm great. Sure our listeners will as well. So when and where will it be available?
It's going to be out this fall. We're shooting for an October launch date officially, and that will be available through Raygun. And so either at their stores in Cedar Rapids and Des Moines, but also online, they'll be able to order it. And I'm pretty sure that people will be able to get it through Amazon as well. So really, they're online booksellers that people use, but also the brick and mortar Raygun stores will have copies.
And you are also busy with one other thing this summer, if we could talk about it just briefly. You're teaching a summer course called Teaching and Learning Iowa's History that you've taught in the past, but this year is a little different. So can you tell us a bit about that class?
Sure. It's a class that has two kind of lanes, two tracks that people can study. And it's a class that is not only available to university students, but also is open to teachers for licensure renewal credit. And then also it's open to the general public for free. So anyone who's interested in this topic is more than welcome to sign up and take the class. It's online, self-paced, asynchronous, so you can go through the materials and the tasks whenever you have time, after work, after the kids go to bed. The first strand that I've done the last few summers is focused on the history of the civil rights movement in Iowa and anti-Black racism in Iowa specifically. And that history is super fascinating, and I think people would be really interested in knowing more about that dimension of our state's history, even lots of important national things that have happened here. And then the second strand that's new this summer looks at struggles for sovereignty in Iowa and Native Americans that do live in the state and have relationships with the state. So that has been a huge learning experience for me. I've worked with Sebastian Brown, who's the director of American Indian Studies at Iowa State, to put the class together. He's been just an incredible resource. And then lots of other people who've been really helpful pointing us to resources and contributing in other ways. Both of those tracks are available right now online. We just started on June 1st, and it's definitely not too late to jump on board if people are interested. So they'll just have to search for Teaching and Learning Iowa History. It's free to register. You just need a password and a username to get into the platform.
How much of this history do you think is being taught in Iowa schools?
You know, not a lot, I would say. And I'm really hoping that that's changing. Last year, the legislature approved new social studies standards, K-12, for the state. And what was really new and different, and is actually very unique relative to states across the country, is that every single grade level now has a standard dedicated to Iowa studies and Iowa history. So I think what's exciting about that is now, instead of just being relegated to fourth grade, or maybe there's a teacher in one district that happens to teach an elective about Iowa history, now every single student in the state and every single teacher is being asked to somehow incorporate that into the curriculum. What that means also, though, is that a lot of people just don't have that background knowledge, don't really have access to resources, which is why I think both this class that I teach in the summers and then also the book that I'm working on and lots of other history books as well that are really helpful, that those can be resources to help educators as they transition to those new standards to make sure that Iowa's history is being taught, it's being taught well, it's being taught inclusively, and it's being taught in a way that helps kids learn to ask really important questions of their communities and learn about participating and being active citizens wherever they live.
And now that you're into the third year of it, what's your sense of the kind of impact and outcomes that it's having?
Well, this summer it was really nice to see. We have over 150 people signed up for both of the tracks. And in the Native American history track, the Iowa Indians option, we have over 20 people who have said, oh, I'm taking this class because I took the other class and it really changed how I taught things. And it opened my eyes to this whole new world of our state's history that I didn't know about. And I'm really excited for that to happen again with another topic. So the fact that you have returning people to do a lot of work in the month of June, that's a good sign, I think. I know the teachers who've taken the class have incorporated it into their curriculum, which is exciting. And then for the first strand, the civil rights movement strand, from that class, I developed a presentation that's just kind of the tip of the iceberg. And so a lot of the participants in the first two summers have asked if I would come and share just snippets from the class and some of those stories at different groups. So some church groups or organizations, social services, different businesses, anyone who wants to know more about that history, just to kind of spread it a little bit further. So it's exciting to me to see the community members who took that class inviting me to come and share more of that information in the spaces that they are leaders in or parts of. And so I think there's been kind of a trickle-down effect, if you will, that there has really been a seepage of those stories out into the community as people took it upon themselves to learn more and then really wanted to share those stories with others around them.
And because this history was something that you probably didn't learn in school,
right?
Then you had to go back and dig up a lot of this information as well and learn this history.
Yeah, I did. And there were some great resources. We're really lucky in the state to have a couple of fabulous museums. The African American History Museum in Cedar Rapids is outstanding. The State Historical Society has educators that are incredibly helpful. The Annals of Iowa is a fantastic online, well, it has a paper copy, but all of its archived articles are online. So people can read about specific histories of the state there. That's been a great resource. And other books specific to those topics written by professional historians who are using Iowa as a case study to think about, you know, whatever topic they're interested in. So, yeah, I definitely had to do a lot of that legwork. But I think that what's exciting about being a professor, especially at a land-grant institution like Iowa State, is that part of my job is to do some of that legwork and then translate that into resources that are helpful to people and applicable to people's everyday lives. And so hopefully this class and this book are examples of me being able to use my resources as a professor to do that.
Well, you have inspired, I think, all of us to learn more about this, made us realize how little we know about the history of Iowa in general, and particularly about the experiences of the marginalized groups that you've been talking about. So thanks.
Well, thanks so much for having me on, Gail. I really, really appreciate it.
That was Katie Swalwell from the School of Education at ISU talking about her book and an online summer course that she teaches. We'll put links from the interview on our website as we post the show. But now I've been joined in the studio by three guests. Mary Rankin from the Office of Sustainability at ISU is here.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming,
Mary. Absolutely, my pleasure.
And you've brought two other guests that I'm going to let you introduce.
All right.
And you're going to tell us what you all have in common in terms of working on Rummage Rampage.
Yes, I am so pleased to have Bill Schmidt joining me, superintendent with the Resource Recovery Center for the City of Ames.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And also Stan Raby. And Stan has so many roles in the community, but today you're representing us as the building manager, did you
sure.
tell me?
Yeah.
Okay, for actors.
Good morning.
And I know that's one of the things, many things that you do. Anyway, what we all have in common today is we have a real interesting and diversified commitment to sustainability in our community related to keeping wonderfully effective and beneficial items from being landfilled. When folks are, even though it feels like summer outside, we're still doing a lot of spring cleaning out there, and we have folks getting ready to leave our community as their leases may run up, or changing apartments as they're as they change leases. This is that time of the year, and we have in common the fact that we see so many unique lawn ornaments, usually in the forms of furniture and household wares and those sorts of things, end up on the curbs this time of the year. And a few years ago, the city and the university got together and said, hey, let's look at an opportunity to actually rehome these items into a place where, you know, these usable items can get more use, stay out of the landfill, and really support economic, environmental, and social sustainability. And so this is our third year now for Rummage Rampage. This is what we have named our event. And the intent of the event, as I said, is to keep useful, beneficial items from being landfilled. Now, in our community, we have this fantastic facility called the Resource Recovery Center. And I know for a lot of folks, the thought is that, oh, all of our garbage, all that we leave on the side of the curb, goes to the Resource Recovery Center and we make fuel from it. Bill, can you talk a little bit about that?
Certainly, I'd be glad to. What we do at the Resource Recovery is all the municipal solid waste from Story County comes into our facility. We grind that material up. We pull out ferrous metals and non-ferrous metals. Those are recycled and reclaimed back into the metal market. Then through our process of grinding the material up and separating it out through a series of air knives, we send the burnable portion over to the power plant that the City of Ames owns, and that's used to generate electricity. About 10% of the electricity that the power plant generates comes from the garbage that people throw away, which is very productive. It's been We're in our 43rd year of doing it. We're the first municipally owned waste-to-energy facility in the United States, and we're the longest operating one municipally. So we're really proud of that fact. What we've noticed over the years during this time period of when we have people moving out is we have items come to us that really do not generate or make good fuel.
They're not beneficial fuel for
Correct.
Us.
Correct. We get the couches. We get the furniture. Even though it may be wood, we can't get it ground up small enough to burn effectively in the furnaces, and it just creates problems for us and the power plant.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the or a lot of the stuff that we get still has a lot of good useful life left in it. And that's the thing that always we look at, how can we get that material and get it reused? We have so much life that's left in it, and we don't need to be throwing it away. So we looked at several different options, and one of the things we came up with was Remedy Rampage.
Yes, and as you mentioned, while it may seem like, oh, it's a desk that has wood in it, or, oh, it's a desk that has, you know, a chair that has upholstery, those mm-hmm. things burn, carpet burns, rugs burn, but the thing is that we have to process it into a form that we can actually use. And the amount of intensity of effort and just the systems, which our systems just aren't able to do, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
We're not able to even though maybe there was could be the possibility of it being burned, it's not beneficial for our system.
Correct.
So with that in mind, when all these things come in, they immediately go to the landfill, correct?
That's correct. We sort those items out, the mattresses, the couches, the desks. All those chairs, all that furniture, that all goes directly to the landfill. During that time period, the end of July, first part of August, our system, the volume going through it triples during that time period because there's just so much material being disposed of and thrown away, and we don't have the time to go through it. So we just get overwhelmed, and we have to take those items and just dispose of them as quickly as possible so that we can handle the rest of the material coming through our system.
Which brings an interesting point, too, because people could say, oh, well, but metal pans, that's metal that gets pulled out of the system. But as you mentioned, there's so much volume.
Correct.
That now, just to make sure that you can process and you can ensure the operations that you need to get done, when loads come into you and they're predominantly these household items, during this time of the year, they're pretty much getting sent to the landfill.
That's correct. We don't have time to sort it out individual item by item. So when we see load come in that's primarily stuff that's not usable for us, we take a big end loader, we scoop it up, we put it in a roll-off, and it gets hauled directly to the landfill.
Right. So this event, then, allows all those usable items to not go to our landfill.
It's so great. It's nice to see items that have useful life be reused rather than just be disposed of and thrown away.
Most definitely. And so let's talk a little bit about what we have accomplished with this event. This is our third year.
Mm-hmm.
The first year, I know you got all the stats in front of you, Bill. Thank goodness you brought all those numbers this morning. What did we do our first year? How many tons of material did we keep from going to the landfill and putting them into homes?
First year, we were able to keep 44,955 pounds out of the landfill.
Wow.
It's just amazing how much material. It was the first time we tried it. I had no idea how it was going to run, how much material we were going to get rid of, how much material we were able to keep out. There was only 310 pounds of material that was donated to us that we were not able to reuse, recycle, or sell.
That's
just
fabulous.
Amazing, yes.
So that's about 20 tons. So you imagine, you know, ton trucks. It's
mm-hmm.
a line of 20-ton trucks that would have otherwise just put all the material in the landfill.
It is. It's just unbelievable how much material we're able to keep out. And that was just in its infancy. We didn't know, I hate to say it, we didn't know what we were doing.
Yes, exactly. And so then year two.
Year two went even better. It's amazing. The last year, we were able to keep 77,520 pounds out of the landfill. Almost 39 tons.
So we doubled, easily doubled what
yes.
we did the year before. Yes, most definitely. And so not only is this event really unique because it helps keep things out of the landfill, but it's also unique in how we have it set up. So we have it set up so that these items are marked to sell.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
But all of the proceeds from the sales go to nonprofit organizations in Ames and Story County.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Stan is here, because Stan was one of our groups. Actors has been with us since the beginning of Rummage Rampage. And could you talk a little bit about being involved with Rummage Rampage? What made Actors, you know, be involved and what the experience has been like?
Actors got involved, I think, very, very early on in terms of the planning of it. And for us, it's first of all, a wonderful opportunity to have an outreach into the community. anything that we can do at the community theater to let people know there is a community theater and that we're active and we participate in the community is good for actors. Secondly, it's a wonderful way for the community theater to raise money because profits from the Rummage Rampage get split among the individual participating volunteer organizations. And so on an hour-by-hour proportional basis for the amount of time that organizations contribute, they get that proportion back from the profits, which is a really good fundraiser for us. The other thing that's great for actors is I'm out there. I'm the first person buying some of this stuff.
As soon as the
sales are open, I'm laying across a desk saying, we get this one for actors. And so when you see somebody laying on a piece of furniture, you know that's me.
It's probably Stan. Yes.
Yeah. Every year we've gotten stage pieces for the show because we're getting really nice pieces of furniture in. Mm-hmm. And for us, we can't store all that kind of furniture. So Rummage Rampage is going to see some of those things come back this year.
So you're recycling it back into the system.
Exactly.
And making that much more money for nonprofits.
That's exactly.
See, it's great.
It's exactly. And, you know, the network that I've developed doing this is fabulous. I mean, I wouldn't have met a lot. I wouldn't have met Bill. I wouldn't, probably except for Marion, you know. So it's a wonderful network to build. It's an awful lot of fun. It's a fundraiser. It's a good networking. It's good for the community. It's good for actors.
Thank you, Stan. And it's been, I mean, these nonprofit organizations that have joined us, and actually there's still time to sign up as a nonprofit organization. I think today is the last day.
Today is the last day.
Yes. But it's been so wonderful for the city and the university to assist getting nonprofit organizations' missions and visions and just ways for folks to get involved with them out into the community as well, as you mentioned, Stan.
Yeah, and I tell you, it's fun that I've been talking to Ben, you know, getting him revved up for Rummage Rampage. He says, oh, yeah, I'll be there.
Yes.
It's something that those of us who have done it look forward to now because it's almost like a reunion.
It is very much a family feeling.
Yeah.
And I will say also that the you know, the folks that donate to Rummage Rampage, we'll talk about how to do that in a minute. But the folks that donate, so there's three ways to get involved. You can donate items. You can volunteer either through a nonprofit organization that you're connected to or just as an individual that wants to give back to the community. And you can also shop. Mm-hmm. And so it's so wonderful to meet the number of really unique, wonderful people that come to donate items, hearing their stories, the people that come to shop and that are just so moved by the fact that they can really redecorate part of their home or they can actually provide, you know, infrastructure pieces to their homes that they otherwise wouldn't be able to easily do.
And the timing is perfect because you have so many students who are moving into apartments for the first time and they're looking for things that they couldn't travel with.
Absolutely.
And so they're able to not just redecorate, but furnish homes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And support themselves.
Right.
And allow themselves through shopping in an event like this. We actually had an international organization, international students that came in and said, you don't understand. We can buy groceries this week instead of next week or, you know, 2 weeks and 3 weeks. So it's just a wonderful event. And we really encourage folks as they're cleaning out closets, as you're doing that cleaning around the house, pull those items aside. Think about donating. If you are a nonprofit organization, and last year our nonprofit organization split $17,000.
That's great.
And so you think about that. That's a pretty nice chunk for a nonprofit organization to make at an event. You can get on the Volunteer Story County website, Volunteer Center of Story County website. It's vcstory.org. You can sign up your nonprofit organization, but you have to do that today. June 8th is the deadline. Then you have to, your commitment in signing up to share in some of these profits is to make sure that you have 10 hours of volunteer service confirmed in the system through the Volunteer Center of Story County by June 30th. June 25th, we will be opening up the website to the general public to register as volunteers. That's how we said. We said as an individual, you can volunteer and help too. When you sign up to volunteer, you need to designate your hours to whatever nonprofit organization is assisting us. And then, of course, the event starts on July 27th. We'll just have donation drop-off that day from noon to 6. And then Saturday the 28th, Sunday the 29th, Monday the 30th, Tuesday the 31st, and Wednesday, August 1st, we will have sales and donations all those days. So that's when you can come in and support us by shopping, and maybe you'll go home and still find some treasures that you want to donate. Our very last half-price day is on Thursday, August 2nd. All items will be half-price. For more information, we would encourage you to go to the Volunteer Center of Story County website, vcstory.org, to do all that sign up as volunteering. And on the City of Ames website, go to the City of Ames website, type in Rummage. You don't even need to type in Rampage. Rummage, Rampage, or just Rummage. And you will go to our website that has all of our dates, information about what you can donate, and information about things you can donate that we will just make sure gets out to the community. Food, blankets for the animal shelters, those sorts of things, and any other information you want to know about Rummage Rampage.
Yeah, I've been involved the first year. Last year I was out of town, but I think I'll be around this year, so I will do my volunteering.
We look forward to having you come. All right, yay. Yeah.
Thank you very much, all of you, for being here. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Jackie Norman. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards. We also heard Little Old Lady from Pasadena by Jan and Dean. Thanks to Katie Swalwell for her interview and to our in-studio guests, Mary Rankin, Bill Schmidt, and Stan Raby. We had our primary elections on Tuesday here in Iowa, and KHOI provided lots of primary election coverage. If those stories appeal to you, why not show your support by joining KHOI? You can do it online at khoifm.org or call 515-292-2878. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. The Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun every Saturday, located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza. The Farmers Market brings fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment.